Hopefully everybody is appropriately caffeinated now, and we're very fortunate to begin another very interesting session. I do have a few housekeeping things just for people to know in advance. For those who have purchased lunch tickets, the lunches can be picked up in the Pickwick Suite, and delegates can also pick up a brochure about local restaurant recommendations at the registration booth. And also during the lunch break, that's a time for poster viewing, and we strongly encourage you to come see the posters that contain a lot of additional information that ramifies some of the discussions we're having here on a larger scale. So it's with great pleasure that I introduce to you Dr. Jeremy Sugarman. Dr. Sugarman is the Harvey M. Meyerhoff Professor of Bioethics and Medicine, Professor of Medicine of Health Policy and Management, and Deputy Director for the Medicine for the Berman Institute of Bioethics at Johns Hopkins University. He's an internationally recognized leader in the field of biomedical ethics, with particular expertise in the application of empirical methods and evidence-based standards for the evaluation and analysis of bioethical issues. So without further ado, Dr. Sugarman.
Thanks, Ken, and thanks for coming back for ethics. Appreciate the invitation to think through some of these ethical issues with you about TASP. It's often said that if you understand the ethical issues about HIV and AIDS, you can understand all there is to know about bioethics. And in part, that's true. Despite all the conversation about TASP, the literature, the academic literature regarding the ethical issues is actually pretty sparse so far. So it was an interesting challenge for me to put this talk together. So I'm going to welcome your comments. I'm sure I'll get the criticisms and complaints, and it's part of my job. I kind of like it. It's the sport of doing bioethics, so I'm looking forward to that. I was given this title. I usually make up shorter titles, Wrestling with the Bioethics of TASP in a World Without Universal ART. And I didn't know if that was sort of an invitation to put up like really erotic wrestling pictures for this group, or whether what you really wanted to see was a bunch of bioethicists wrestle up here, which I probably don't recommend watching bioethicists wrestle. If you want to watch wrestling, I'd go somewhere else for that. Let me start with some caveats here. The first caveat is actually not even listed, is that there's an obligation to do the work we're doing, that we live in this world where HIV still remains an enormous problem. I'm preaching to the choir here, but we have an obligation to take multiple approaches to ending the epidemic. And here in the caveats and with what I say today is the status of the science and policy is rapidly changing. Some of the issues I may raise today may be resolved, but even more likely we'll have new ethical issues that'll come up. We also live in a world of marked disparities, which complicates considerations related to HIV and AIDS, especially with prevention and treatment. One disease, one approach, one infection can't solve all the global inequity problems, and epidemics that take place within that are sensitive to these issues are especially problematic. And while I might seem to be trying to cause trouble at times, in the short term they may complicate your lives if you think you've already come up with solutions. In the long term, they're meant to be productive, and please take them with that in mind. So in order to take on, I've gotten rid of the wrestling piece, but in order to take on this issue of in a world without universal ART, I think we need to start with what the bioethics issues are of TASP in general, and then move on to the special considerations that take place in a world without universal ART. So the three domains of issues I want to touch on here is things that you've heard alluded to that have ethical implications. The bioethics of TASP, all things considered, are acceptability, safety, and alternatives. So the acceptability of TASP, we want to divide that into HIV-positive persons and HIV-negative persons. One of the things that we need to think of from the beginning, as we've couched it as sort of a scientific, a logistical, a rollout, a practical question, has been medicalization prior to sickness. So the notion that we see someone as sick or ill once diagnosed is actually a sort of sociologic phenomenon about when people believe that they are sick. When people, you saw different data being presented over the course of the last couple of days in which you heard recognition that when people are sick, they're retained in care. Well, that's okay. Why would you want to, I mean, some people like to play doctor or go to doctors when they're not sick, but why would you want to medicalize yourself before you were feeling sick? And that's a really important consideration about what our health-seeking behaviors are and what it means as a person to believe in myself as a healthy person versus someone who is requiring or using therapy, even if it's for myself or for others. ART use and lifelong adherence is obviously an important consideration. Taking ART and taking it forever is something that is an important decision for individuals as well as clinicians in the face of guidelines. While guidelines work across populations, the question for an individual is, can I do this? Ought I do this? Will I be able to continue doing this? Do I want to do this? Can I afford to do it? Can I get it over time? Those are crucial because they're not only autonomy interests, but they're well-being interests for self, right? If I stop, if I interrupt therapy, there are implications for self and how I view my own quality of life. There will be side effects, as was mentioned. The medications may get better and easier to take, but it is clear that there are going to be side effects from these decisions that are made, as well as the absolutely great reasons to start early treatment. The risks can be physical, which tend to be addressed, and we also heard some discussion about the social risks of treatment. What does it mean to have those pills? What does it mean to be stigmatized? How does that play out in populations, subpopulations, at-risk populations, need to be considered so that in the approach to helping the individual, they're not inadvertently harmed. And finally, crucial to my heart, my favorite enzyme is informed consent. I love informed consent. It is just one of the coolest things in the whole wide world for dignity reasons, respect reasons. The problem is most people limit it to a form and are sort of, you know, think it's that about. No, informed consent's the greatest thing, but I wasn't asked to give a talk on consent. Maybe next time. But if you ask me, I'll tell you why consent's really good later. But the issue here with starting treatment, obviously, is one where there are implications for self as well as implications for others. And the implications for treatment require behaviors on the part of the individual. Counseling, consent, and an understanding of what's going on is essential to well-being. We can't do this as a one-time treatment, a one-off. It requires sustained attention. Now, for the HIV-negative person, when we're thinking about tasks, you have to rely on the actions of others. It's basically the prevention modality that relies on other people doing something so your safety is continued. That requires both trust and trustworthiness. One has to trust in the other person and believe that the individual who says that she or he is taking ART is actually doing that. In addition to the complex scientific question about whether it really works in that individual and at what point does it sort of kick in and what kind of breaks from that will happen. But the real issue is, can I trust you when we're about to have sex, we're about to share needles, to believe that you're really taking that drug? We know that all relationships cannot be trustworthy, and we know that in certain settings this is not going to be the case. Now, ideally, when we saw the beautiful results from 052, where we had sort of mostly dyadic relationships, but where did you see transmission events? Sometimes outside those relationships. Guess what? We have science that shows us that people have sex outside of dyadic relationships. Did anybody know that? I never heard about it because, you know, in ethics, we're kind of pure and good and stuff. So I think we need to really think carefully about what those issues are going to be and whether that trust is deserved in different contexts. And finally, something we've coined a term called preventive misconception, just like something you may have heard of, the therapeutic misconception. And when people are enrolled in research, they erroneously believe that the thing being tested will certainly be therapeutic. We're doing research to find out whether something is therapeutic. We've coined the term to apply to prevention modalities about whether if you're enrolled in research or you're sometimes taking something for the sake of prevention, that it will clearly work to prevent whatever you're hoping to do. Preventive misconception obviously would be problematic if you change your risk behaviors as a result of a preventive misconception. The concern about whether it's risk compensation or other things, let's just say a change in behaviors in one direction or another, could radically affect the ability to prevent things if your behaviors change so radically, right? So I don't need to play this out for you, but the issue is, do we inadvertently cause harm by talking about the certainty with which a certain approach, say TASP, is going to work for prevention? So safety and effectiveness, we believe, is going to be contingent on good delivery systems, the extent to which people are monitored, they're able to comply, and the costs of doing so are going to play a role not just in resource-limited settings, but also in research-rich settings, about how do we best do this monitoring, how do we do lifelong anything that is acceptable to people over the long term. And then the effectiveness issue, which has been raised in a couple of talks, raises questions before, you know, prior to any kind of rollout, about what is the effectiveness of different interventions in different population groups. We need to also think about alternatives, because either for individuals who don't provide consent, or where we can't muster the resources, or we don't have delivery systems in place, about what are alternatives that people may reasonably try to prevent themselves from becoming infective. There are existing methods, some of which have been discussed. Satisfaction with different methods are different for different people. Some people love latex, some people hate latex. Some people, you know, it's everybody's different approaches. Existing approaches such as PrEP for different individuals, and it may be really crucial for a set of individuals who cannot be in trustworthy relationships to protect themselves at different times. And how does that work? Is really important. So that these alternatives are out there, we're trying to learn about alternatives. We're trying to learn about, can we improve even the alternatives as we proceed with TASP? And finally, the aspirational ones. These are important to throw onto the table for considerations, only because if you listen to some of the conversations at hand, both with vaccines and HIV cure research, you hear a story from people. They understand, you know, there seems to be growing global understanding that ART can be used for treatment and prevention. That's great. People don't tend to love the idea of taking lifelong medication. And so this hope for a vaccine, despite a lot of the problems that have been associated with vaccine trials over the long haul, if you could provide a vaccine, that would be stunning. And the rollout issues that we would have with vaccines could be problematic, but probably not as problematic as some of the things like voluntary male circumcisions we've had and sort of the slower uptake over time. So the hope for a vaccine is there because of the sort of less burdensome ability for individuals. In the discussions of HIV cure, if you just watch the attention, both deserved and undeserved, around HIV cure headlines, what you see is this clamoring for access to things that would cure people of a disease. Cure people of any disease is a good thing. One that's stigmatized and requires lifelong treatments, another. So on the horizon, thinking about why people are thinking about that can help us reflect on what we're doing here. Well, let's, if those weren't hard enough, here's the hard question I was given. The considerations in a world without universal ART. And let's look here at three domains: safety, fairness, and allocation. So safety goes towards the issue about delivery systems. Much like HIV treatment, Joe Gallant, Shruti Mitta, and I have discussed this issue before, is like, what are the delivery systems to be able to enable adequate monitoring so that we are safely delivering ART for prevention, ART for treatment? And what's the ART quality that's going to be used there? Are they drugs that are not used because of their risk profile? What's the quality of those agents? Are they rogue agents, or are they generic agents? Are they good agents? How are they being delivered? Can we make sure that as a result of giving something to people, that, again, we don't harm them? This goes back to that, you know, that famous hypocritical oath. It's hypocritical, right? I think it is. No, oh, Hippocratic Oath, that thing about not harming. You know, in our desire to help, we're not supposed to harm. This is a great aside. Some people have told me this before. You know, they say that doctor's first principle is primum non nocere or nocere, depending on your Latin teacher. Right? People have heard that. So what language was that? Trick question. I just said it. Latin. Okay, I said it's Latin, depending on your Latin teacher. So primum non nocere. Well, the Hippocratic Oath actually comes from the Greek physicians. They were in the 5th century BC when they said that stuff. Latin wasn't invented yet. They couldn't have said that. Okay, so they didn't say it. We don't know who. And Hagar, a very famous medical ethicist, you know, publishes in the comic section each day, once said you should trust doctors more in the first slide. The second slide says it worries me they needed a principal to figure that out. Right? So this idea of medicine, what's the ethic of medicine, is it is to help and at least not harm. Okay? So help and at least not harm. We want to make sure we're doing that in the process of doing what we're doing. And sustainability is key. And so drug stockouts, shortages, availability, changing global economies, none of that would happen once we start treatment, right? Those issues are paramount to the safety of the individuals, the safety of communities, the safety of community viral load, resistance patterns, and the like. And so these issues are ones that are quite serious that become elaborated as we roll out larger programs. Fairness is an issue. Fairness comes from the ethical principle of justice. Doesn't mean just us, right? Got that? Right? So fairness, Aristotle had trouble sorting this out in the Nicomachean Ethics. He's saying, what does it mean? It's all of justice or all of virtue. When we think, is that just? Is it fair? But also, it's justice and allocation. How do we give things out or how do we treat people fairly? One thing to be considered is as we move out programs and as we begin to do this, we don't all of a sudden turn on a switch and the globe gets ART. It's how do we select communities initially raises huge questions of fairness. Once we've selected different communities or programs or countries or whatever the jurisdiction is, how do we select clients within those communities? If you talk to people about PEPFAR rollout, Global Fund rollout, how people in communities actually got to be the first ones raised some questions that we just don't talk about. Well, those questions we don't talk about, those questions of fairness, of who gets it. Is it the brother of the nurse in the clinic? Is it the person who walked the farthest? Is it the person who was first online? Is it the person who is sickest? Those questions raise huge issues of equity and fairness that we need to address without a world of universal ART. And finally, when it comes to questions of allocation, we have to say, how can we allocate ART, which we might focus on in this room? How do we focus on allocating resources to ART and to non-ART-based approaches to prevention? If the goal is prevention of infection, what are the conflicts that we have in advocating for one method over another? Where there's scientific information to drive that decision, the modeling takes us the same direction, the science takes us one direction, the autonomy and community-based interests take us one direction, that's one thing. But as we advocate for different things, what are the questions of fairness that go into allocation? And what we need to remember, as was brought out in the last couple of presentations, is HIV is critically important, but the places that HIV predominantly affects individuals and communities, there are syndemics, there are other epidemics, there are other problems that range from everything from infectious diseases, which were put on the slides, but also things like road safety, which kill more people. Okay? And so we have to think broadly about how we allocate resources if we want to live in a healthy world. So the allocation of ART is one I want to bring up because this is the issue that has predominated in the ethics discourse, as limited as it has been, with respect to TASP. And the assumption here is one of scarcity. So if the scarcity issue can go away, the ethical problems get solved. Some of the scarcity issues have changed radically over time. If you would have thought that we've had the rollout that we've had that's been remarkable, we never would have anticipated, I don't think, how we've seen a global response to the epidemic. It's not done yet, right? It's not everyone who needs a drug, wants a drug, still not getting it. But the assumption of scarcity could be solved if we could, you know, it takes away a lot of the ethical issues. You'd still have the ones I mentioned before. So the question is, how do you allocate that ART if ART is relatively scarce or funding for ART or the provision of ART is scarce? You can give them for treatment, can give it for TASP, you could give it for prevention, and under prevention, you could use those ARTs for PMTCT and maybe B+, maybe PEP, and maybe PrEP. And so those same drugs, right, might be, if you could really move them in categories, and you said, if I was ethics king for the day, right, how would I allocate those things fairly? It would raise an important set of questions, but those are key questions to think about in how we allocate. Now, the intuitive argument is one which Ruth Macklin and Ethan Cowan have proposed. Sort of resonates with what you might think if you come to a problem. It's okay to assume things initially, is that if we're kind of in a shortage of ART, first we ought to give it for treatment, then we ought to give it for treatment as prevention because of the beauty of both treating an individual and preventing a disease, and then finally we might give it for PrEP. Now you notice that they didn't include earlier methods of TASP or PrEP, like decreasing vertical transmission and PEP. They didn't put that in there. Not sure why. Why aren't those things on the radar screen for consideration when we make an ethics argument about that? They put them in that order. Now, they then look at a bunch of moral principles regarding justice. Now, if you really want to try to get perplexed about theories and ethics, this stuff will kill you. Theories of justice, they are the hardest part of medical ethics, bioethics. We are not settled. There has never been a settled theory of justice. And so often what happens is when you see bioethicists not wrestling, I've actually, known Ruth Macklin for a long time, and I've never wrestled with her. She'd probably win, but she's pretty strong. But the whole issue about different theories of justice come from different camps, just like there are PrEP camps and TASP chance and PEP and condom camps. There are justice camps. And different ways of giving out of goods is when I also describe this in my, if I'm teaching in university, and I'll say, okay, I have a pizza today. How do I give this pizza out to the seminar? And just like I mentioned before, what's the right way to give out the pizza? It's cut into 8 slices. I don't know why there's this universal thing about cutting pizzas into 8 slices, but there is. There's some universal law. And how do I give that pizza out to my seminar group? Do I give it to the person who came first? Do I give each person a piece, even though some people may be hungrier than others? Do I give it to the person who took her insulin before class and needs it to prevent a crisis? I mean, and you can go on about how best to do this. So the different theories of justice are utilitarian. We want to balance the best interests of the population over time. Equity, we just give things fairly to different pockets. So in this case, we give some to prevention, some to treatment, some as treatment as prevention. Do we give it to those in most urgent need? Do we do it based on a prioritarian people principle of the least well-off? Do we rescue those in front of us like a Good Samaritan principle, or do we assume that all human beings are of equal worth? You've heard all those arguments, right? And there are different theories of justice that hold each of those out there. Macklin and Cowan take the ones with the asterisks, urgent need, prioritarian, and rule of rescue, and think if you put all three of those together, it argues that the intuitive argument is correct, that you should treat those who are sick first, then treatment as prevention, and then PrEP. Let me look at their argument. For urgent need, the prevention of less urgent public health needs and uninfected may not become infected, right? So the idea here is that if we allocate things to prevention, those people may never get infected, and so we're wasting the ART. Okay, they may never get it, but the people certainly need it when they're sick. The counterargument, as Stuart Rennie pointed out, is that prioritizing treatment over prevention simply pushes the urgency to another day. We know that the rates are going to happen. We know people are going to get infected. And so what we do is we take this certain problem, but we know that later on more people or same number of people become infected. The prioritarian principle, those infected are the least advantaged versus those who are at high risk of becoming infected. The counterargument, here's a little more Latin for you, hic et nunc. Hey, I like that one. Ethics got really good words. It's here and now. So it's the immediate person right in front of you. This is what clinicians, when I see patients in clinic and I have my white coat on, it's that patient in front of me here and now versus sort of my public health hat, which is sort of the population-based level. Here and now, compassion is appropriate. That's true. We don't want to take that away. But why should it trump the reality of those least who will be least well off in the future? And finally, the rule of rescue, this obligation to help identify others who are already infected. The counterargument to that one is that future suffering and death are also significant, that we can't discount the fact that it's the number of dead people overall that matters. We want to keep most people alive. And so what you see is if you examine the arguments by Cowan and Macklin, they don't hold. They don't hold with certainty. Okay? And there's some other counterarguments to sort of just assuming that that argument's correct. Inconsistency argument. We love tearing people apart for inconsistencies in arguments. I probably made some inconsistent arguments here. You'll point them out, and I'll just be deflated. So the whole idea is if ART is scarce and you're privileging treatment greater than TASP, the world has many people who lack treatment. Why are we putting any ARTs to treatment as prevention if we haven't treated those who are sick? Okay, that's the logical inconsistency of that, the prior argument. There's an alleviation bias that takes place in not just HIV, but in all sort of fields where we put many more resources to treatment than prevention. We tend to have a psychological, moral intuition that what we want to do is alleviate rather than prevent. Utilitarian arguments play a role in many of our public health policies, and so why wouldn't it matter here? Consequences do matter. It's not just being a good person, doing it, you know, and sort of doing the right thing if the consequences are wrong. Brock and Wickler have argued that actually, counter to Macklin and Cowan, it's important to make have utilitarian considerations in mind. From a human rights argument, the issue is there's a need to prevention for prevention among disadvantaged populations in which TASP isn't going to be the reality. And Jerome uses the issue of young women in South Africa. You could take the same approach to violence against MSM in many parts of the world and what options they might have for prevention. And finally, the issue of solidarity, what do communities want as they think together about the well-being of communities as a whole. So we're left with this issue of allocation of ARTs, of ART and non-ART-based approaches to prevention, and also HIV and non-HIV priorities. What we are to do is, as we move forward, be sensitive to these issues. How do we get around it? There's some evolving work in social justice, newer theories of justice, that look at well-being more broadly and look at different domains of health and well-being. That well-being includes health, but also personal security, reasoning, respect, attachment, and self-determination. Some really interesting work by Wolf and DeShalit says we've got to think about the security of well-being. So it's not just a one-time fix. This idea about things like vaccines or cures has some resonance because it ensures security of well-being that doesn't rely on the actions of others that, well-intentioned or not, may be out of their control. So in closing, what I want to hope I've left you with is that TASP is extremely promising means of helping others in the pandemic. You know, I played a small role in L5-2, and I can tell you it's really exciting, and I love it. But like most, if not all, intervention, TASP involves ethical challenges, which are exacerbated by global disparities of health, wealth, particular vulnerabilities of those infected, and also people are at heightened risk. And one of the ways we get around this is when we can't come up with a simple answer is to ensure that we have transparent and explicit deliberations about these issues with meaningful engagement to help ensure that we get it closer to right than we would if we just sat in a room and thunk it up ourselves. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Jeremy, for a really thoughtful, provocative presentation.